Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey everybody, it's Michael Steele. Yes, I'm still around. Yeah, we're getting into summer. Y'all think I'm going to be at the beach, right? Ocean City? Nah, I'm here working for you, baby. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. It's always great when you drop in for a conversation. Look, this is the end of June, and in this time of year, this season, is rife with anticipation because there's this very quiet third branch of government known as the judiciary. And at the top of that is the Supreme Court. Well, they get mighty active this time of year, and they start handing down decisions right and left. And so as they're in the throes of doing that, we thought it would be a great idea to get someone who's not only in the mix, but knows how the mix is made. And that's our guest for this conversation. She is Dahlia Lithwick. I love that name. I love it. It's just got all kinds of, like, you know, novelistic kind of tendencies to it. She's a senior editor at Slate, where she has written her Supreme Court dispatches and jurisprudence columns since 1999. Her work has also appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The New Republic, and Commentary. She is host of Amicus, Slate's award-winning biweekly podcast about the law and the Supreme Court. In 2018, Ms. Lithwick received the American Constitution Society's Progressive Champion Award and the Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis. So she knows what she's doing in this space. She was the first online journalist invited to be on the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press, and she serves on the board of the Jefferson Center for Free Expression. She's currently working on a new book, Lady Justice, for Penguin Press. All right. Welcome, Dahlia. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. I have to stop you and tell you that Rush Limbaugh once said live on air, responding to something that I had written, that it sounded like that was my stripper name. So I just, you hear novelistic and he hears pole dancing. So let's leave that there. But I just needed to say
it. I think that says more about Rush than it does about you. God bless you. So, you know, we'll just leave that sitting on the pole.
Let's do that.
That's hysterical. Oh, my God. I love it when conservatives think they're throwing down some smack on people and they make these obscure ass references to things that don't even, I mean, it's not even like connecting. It's not even in the same zip code. And then you just, anyway, it's just always hysterical to me how they, and it, you know, it's always with women too. They do these sort of, you know, these put downs that have something to do with prostitution or whatever. God bless. Anyway, so I see the great author and the great the great legal thinker. He sees a stripper. What can I say? It's so stupid. So, okay. You really kind of threw me off on that because I'm like, now I got to get serious and talk about the law.
Apologies.
All I've got are, you know, dimly lit strip club rooms in my mind at the moment. Anyway, all right. So the Supreme Court has come out, started coming up with its decisions, and as we begin to head into the last week of these decisions, what's your assessment of what the court has said and done so far, in your view?
Well, I think it's the most interesting thing I could say, Michael, is what it hasn't done. And what it hasn't done is been a 6-3 kind of conservative supermajority juggernaut. Mm-hmm. I think that if you remember back to the fall when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died and Amy Coney Barrett was quickly installed in her seat, there was a real feeling that, at least for progressives, this was the beginning of the end. You know, that the 5-4 court, or probably more pointedly, the 4-4 court with John Roberts in the middle that mm-hmm. we were getting accustomed to, that was no longer, and we were going to see a 6-3 machine that was going to eviscerate the ACA, you know, do away with Obamacare and do away with abortion and do, you know, privilege gun rights and do all these things. The court has done none of those things. So I think the first thing that has happened is that to the extent that we are seeing a fractured court, really interestingly, we're seeing a court with a big bump in the middle that is John Roberts, Amy Coney Barrett, probably Stephen Breyer on the mm-hmm. left, Brett Kavanaugh, who's been mm-hmm. in the majority more than anyone else, and then a very angry Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas, sometimes with Neil Gorsuch, on the right. And so in some sense, we're getting a court that is much less 6-3 kind of machete of, of conservatism, much more a court in which six conservatives are going to work out, sometimes very angrily and publicly, their own differences about how conservative they want to be.
Well, you know, I'm glad we start here. You started us here in this conversation, because it has been my contention, knowing a few of these justices from over the years, and that this idea that somehow these individuals who come out of the Federalist Society mold, which, despite what some people may think or feel about how they may feel about the Federalist Society, is really anchored in some time-honored principles regarding the independence of the court, stare decisis, tradition of jurisprudence, not going in and throwing the baby out with the bathwater, not trying to put new plumbing in, but really keeping on a consistent pattern, that it has been amazing to me how these so-called conservatives outside of the legal community, those more in the political class, have no clue about who these individuals really are and how they will approach their responsibilities as a Supreme Court justice. And the first obvious blow to this notion that, and I love the way you put it, you know, the 6-3 machete of conservatism just striking down all of these liberal pillars of injustice, looked at the ACA and said, no, we're good. That works. First time. Second time. Still good. Still good. You know, third time. No, really, it's okay. Trust us. It's okay. We're not changing it. And then, you know, all of a sudden now these right wing nuts are running around. And I say that not with affection, by the way. So just so we're clear, because these people are not conservatives. They do not understand what conservatism means. They don't understand it in the William F. Buckley tradition or some of the other great writers who've talked about the court and how conservatism plays itself out. It's not about striking down Roe versus Wade. That's not a conservative act. But anyway, I digress. It really is about honoring what the court and its traditions have meant to the balance of power on the one hand, and upholding the constitutional norms on the other that are act as guideposts for the legislature and the executive branch so that they don't go astray of what the founders had put on paper and how that has come to be interpreted over generations. So even with a decision like, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, Plessy versus Ferguson, or the Dred Scott decision, even when the court gets it wrong, it finds a way to get it right. And that's that to me, you know, because quite honestly, you know, a lot of these conservatives today would look at Dred Scott and say, I don't see what the problem is.
Right.
You know, I don't, what's the point? You know, that's, you know, but the court realized even if it took time later, that's not really what the constitutional principle of, you know, freedom and individual liberty and all of that really means. And so I appreciate the way you put it. What does that say about the Roberts Court in these times? And do you think there's more disappointment ahead for these so-called conservatives?
I love how you frame that, Michael, because I think it really proves up to me that it is the Roberts Court and that John Roberts is exactly the institutional small C conservative you just described.
Yep.
And if you think about this time last year, the sense of the world was, you know, this is John Roberts' world. We're all living in it. He was getting to five, getting to six, right? Doing deals. And it was very clear. I'm thinking of the Louisiana abortion clinics case, that he would hive off and vote with the liberal wing for exactly the principles you just laid out, right? Stare decisis. We're not going to reverse whole women's health right after it came out. That I hated that holding, but that's the holding of the court. That was John Roberts, right? And we saw that time again. And you're also right that it really frustrated movement conservatives who thought he was going to simply, you know, do the party line, even if it meant sacrificing those other principles. What the most interesting turn is that once Justice Barrett comes on the court, and it looks like he might be irrelevant now, right? Mm-hmm. It looks like he's not going to get to five because there's not four Ginsburg.
Right.
But he's still doing it.
Yeah.
He is doing exactly the thing you're describing. And the ACA case that you started with is so emblematic of that. So is Fulton. That's the case out of Philadelphia, the Catholic Social Services challenge to Philadelphia's civil rights. And I think that what you are describing is the way in which John Roberts has kind of swathed himself in those principles about the court as an independent third branch, the court as above politics. It's not always true, by the way. I mean, I think we should be honest that sometimes he is a conservative actor. But I think you're exactly right to say that he, as a person, as a chief justice, has modeled himself, he always says, after John Marshall, the great chief justice, and that he has institutional prerogatives that transcend what Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley want him to do in any given case. And so in a weird way, even a year later, when it's a 6-3 court, it's still the John Roberts court. Even though he should have been sidelined, he's still the one who is doing the deals, setting the tone, and doing these very narrow, very circumscribed, as you say, judicially modest opinions, because it's really important to him that those values, those institutional sort of Article III values, are preserved. And the amazing part, the part nobody expected, is that the Trump justices, particularly Kavanaugh and Barrett, are online with that project.
Well, that's because if the hype ahead of their nomination and elevation to the court means anything, they're strict constructionists. They're, Amy Coney Barrett and is, you know, out of the Alito, not Alito, Scalia, you know, is in line with Scalia. And Scalia, even in some of his decisions, you know, drew concern of, you know, these some conservatives because of the positions, it's a political thing that he took on some of the some of the cases that came his way, and you know, they just scratched their head when, you know, the conservatives on the court aligned with the liberals on the court. And like, well, you know, does that mean that those conservatives are now liberals, or those liberals are now conservatives? No, that means that they looked at the facts in front of them. They applied the Constitution to it, and they said, okay, this either fits or it doesn't. It either works or it doesn't. And that's something to me that's very interesting. And you know, I love it's probably folklore now around Washington. And so, but you being as tied into the court as you are, you will know if it's true or not. So we'll just dance with this a little bit. I have deep admiration for John Roberts. I've gotten to know him through both, you know, the public circuit, you know, that we, before COVID, we would, you know, see each other at events, and certainly in the Catholic community as a Catholic member as well. And after Kavanaugh's hearing and his elevation to the court, when he arrived, so the story goes, Roberts pulled him aside, because you know how Kavanaugh got. I mean, he just got all up in the politics. He sounded like a political hack in his response to the attacks, not like a judge who's like, you know what, just, you know, water off a duck's back. He took it personally, and he came back and had, you know, that ugly face picture of him and just all of that. So he gets to the court and in one of his first meetings with the Chief Justice, Roberts supposedly told him, "We don't do that here." Meaning, we don't play politics here. You leave that out there. And I think there's a certain discipline, and there's a certain kind of truth that the Chief Justice puts in front of all of his members to say, this is how we work up here. You know, you guys may have been embroiled in political battles for your, you know, during your nomination and all of the right and the left stuff, but here, this is the water's edge. It stops. And I think that's important for his court, which I also think it makes it maybe a little bit easier for him to build those coalitions around certain cases, because people respect and trust him not to do the politics, not to do the political thing, and not to make a case like the Fulton versus City of Philadelphia case we're going to talk about in a second more political than it otherwise is.
I love that. And I also think it answers the question on the left. We are now well into what, week 8, 9, 10 of Breyergate, where yes, people are, you know, the yes, inimitable, you know, open letter to Justice Breyer. And there's signs like on trucks in D.C. that are demanding that he retire. And that's the exact same principle, I think, that Justice Breyer, the more you tell him, make this emphatically political decision about the court by retiring so you can be replaced before Mitch McConnell can block you. And by the way, Mitch McConnell has pledged, right, to block any Biden nominee if he gets control of the Senate. And Breyer is doing exactly the thing that you are describing, this admonition to Kavanaugh, right, from the chief, which is, right, I am not going to perform politics for you. I am not. The more you press me to perform politics, to make a politically timed decision about my retirement, the more I dig in. And it's the same, you know, we hate that because, you know, people, as you say, look at the court as an entirely political partisan machine. And the problem is the legitimacy, the totality of the legitimacy of the court, right? This is the Federalist Papers, neither the purse nor the sword. All they have is public legitimacy.
That's it.
And so when the chief says to Kavanaugh, you know, swats him across the nose and says, we don't play that way, or when Justice Breyer goes in front of Harvard and gives this speech in April where he says, we are not junior varsity politicians, we don't do things for partisan reasons, you can laugh and say that that's naive or it's aspirational or fanciful, but the totality of the legitimacy of the institution rests in that principle. And telling justices stop acting as though it does strikes me as just both short-sighted in terms of course they're going to behave that way, but also, if you care about the institution, these Article III principles you laid out at the beginning, then you should care about that appearance too, even if it strikes you as hopelessly naive, because they will adhere to it if we demand it of them.
Well, what's so important about what you said is what these justices, all of them, whether it's Sotomayor or Clarence Thomas, what they all understand is they, in one sense, can't play the politics. You know why? Because I'm on the court for damn near the rest of my life. So if I'm on the court, if I get appointed to the court in my mid-40s, and I'm now sitting there at 80, I'm looking at how many presidents, you know, how many congresses. So they're the only consistent thing we have among the three branches of government is the Supreme Court. So they can't afford to play the politics because the politics changes. And so the law and the Constitution has to have some kind of a bedrock to it. It's got to be somewhere. It's got to be stable. It's got to be something you can rely on, because we know the politics changes, and so it does behoove them to approach their job not in the space of political whims. But in the space of looking at the longer the game, and that also requires looking back. That's why stare decisis and tradition, capital T, matter as much as what is right in front of them in the moment.
You know what? You've also just answered this question of why it is that Thomas and Alito are so mad, right? Because they can't play the long game. They're getting old. I think you're looking at, you know, Bush 1 and Bush 2 judges who are feeling that they don't have 20 years, they don't have 30 years to effectuate the things they want. And it is exactly why the Trump justices, even though, as you say, they come out of the Federalist Society, they're handpicked by Leonard Leo, you know, they are selected in order to help make these outcomes come true. They look around and say, I don't need to do it this term. I can do it in 5 years. I can do it in 10 years. This is a long game. And I think that that's exactly the answer to the absolute uncanny frustration. If you think about last week, you know, when Alito was on, quote unquote, the losing side in the Affordable Care, you know, Act case, certainly on the losing side in Fulton, and how angry he is. What he's angry about is, dude, I've been on the court for a really long time, and I would like to see certain outcomes, and they're not happening. And I think that when you are in your 50s, you have the luxury of saying, these things are going to happen. And we should be really clear, I think, that the court, I wrote a very stupid piece a few weeks ago where I said, hey, you know, it's working. They're not taking a big Second Amendment gun challenge, you know, to broaden the rights after Heller. They're not taking a court that's going to kneecap Roe v. Wade. And like within a week of that, they took both of those cases for next term. So I couldn't have been more wrong. My sense was that they were going to go slower. But I do think that what you've just like laid out really explains why, if you're Kavanaugh, if you're Gorsuch, if you're Barrett, and if you're the chief, you can look around at the landscape and say, I don't have to get it all done today.
Right.
If you're Sam Alito and you've been trying to get this done, then it's very maddening to have the court, particularly on Fulton, particularly on the Affordable Care Act. We saw it this week with the union's decision out of California. Those are, you know, those really matter. They've been priorities for a long time. And when they don't come about, I guess Alito was on the winning side in the union's case. But I think that that's where you see that frustration.
Yeah,
that I don't have 30 years to do this.
You don't. They don't. And they realize that, you know, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that they can't force the cases to come up through the system to get in front of them. And even when they do sometimes, the energy inside the court is to say, nah, we're not going to deal with that. And they just, they don't accept it, which they did that. What case was that this week where they didn't even entertain, they just said, no, we don't want to hear the case. I forget which one that was. it'll come to me. But I mean, they have that tendency to sort of, you know, to your point about the long game, to say, no, not now. We're not going to deal with that particular subject matter. And it puts the light, for example, on two cases I want to get into with you. The first is, and you wrote about it, in your conversation with Erwin Chemerinsky. So this is the Fulton versus City of Philadelphia case, which was a 9-0 decision by the court dealing with major religious freedom. So this case, as Erwin noted, Philadelphia contracts with social services agencies to do inspections and placements with regard to foster care. And the City of Philadelphia said, in an order for social service agencies to contract, it has to agree to not discriminate on the basis of sex, race, religion, sexual orientation. Catholic Social Services, which I'm very familiar with as a member of the Board of Catholic Charities here in Washington, brought a challenge to this and said because of its religious beliefs, it would not attest that it would not discriminate. And in fact, it could not place children with same-sex couples. The lower court, the district court in the U.S. Court of Appeals to the Third Circuit, ruled in favor of Philadelphia and against Catholic Services. It gets to the Supreme Court, and what happens?
This is a follow-on to a whole line of cases. People probably know the famous one is the Masterpiece Cake Shop, right? Where the baker in Colorado says that he cannot, in accordance with his faith, produce a cake to solemnize a same-sex wedding. And that case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And Anthony Kennedy is still on the court at the time, so it's pre-Kavanaugh, writes a very, very narrow opinion, essentially saying, look, I am solicitous to the nth degree of gay rights, right? He wrote every important gay rights case of our lifetimes, including Obergefell, the marriage equality case. But I've always had in the back of my head that there needs to be an escape valve for religious dissenters, for religious objectors. And mm-hmm. that has been, in some sense, the collision between those two sets of values, LGBTQ equality on the one hand, and religious dissenters who cannot, under the constraints of their faith, do anything that puts an imprimatur of approval on marriage equality. That line of cases really, excuse me, comes to a head here in Fulton. Because as you just said, we now have on a collision course these civil rights laws, these public accommodation laws that say you don't get to, in the City of Philadelphia, be a licensed, taxpayer-funded, you know, foster care placement entity or approval entity, and also discriminate. You don't get to do those two things. Right. And just as Masterpiece Cake Shop was this really deft, almost a decision not to decide, in Masterpiece Cake Shop, the Supreme Court ended up saying, of course we believe in these civil rights and public accommodation laws, but we need to allow that the state discriminated against this baker in the way they made the decision and the statements they made. That almost is completely imported into Fulton. So what you have, and this is where it's really masterful, a 9-0 opinion, right? Props to John Roberts, where he gets the far right and the far left of the court to sign on to opinion that essentially does the same thing. In a sense, they decide not to decide because what they say is we're not going to make a big proclamation about whether civil rights wins out on the one hand or whether Catholic social services wins out on the other. We are simply going to say that in this particular instance, the city looks like it has exceptions. It allows the city to say there's exceptions for certain foster care entities. And because of that, it's not a rule of sort of general applicability under the test that's the determinant of that. And that if there are exceptions, then they cannot be said to be. And he also says it's not a public accommodation, which is a remarkable part of this decision. And therefore, it looks like the city in this instance discriminated against Catholic social services. And it looks as though we're not going to make a pronouncement. We're not going to do away with employment division versus Smith, which is the test right. that has long stood to determine this. And you just end up with almost a decision not to decide. Slight thumb on the scale for Catholic social services. The decision was wrongly taken, but we're not going to make a big global pronouncement about these competing two values.
And what does that mean, Dahlia? I mean, because a decision not to decide means at some point a future court is going to have to decide. I mean, conservatives, if nothing, they are dogged in their determination to overturn certain social, what have become social norms. So I see future challenges to marriage, Burgerfeld. I see future challenges to Roe, obviously, and future challenges in this religious freedom space. While this was a win, arguably, There will be other cases, and I would suspect a rise from those on the more progressive left end of the spectrum that will come back to make the case that these types of institutions, okay, fine. If you want to play that way, if you want to say that they can discriminate, then take away their tax subsidies. That's the next, and that will, for me, when that case comes, that will be a very interesting. It'll be interesting to hear how some conservatives howl, because they will be howling, when that case gets in front of them. So what do cases like this mean going forward? What do you look out for? And maybe even what do you see currently on the landscape that could give rise to that kind of a challenge in one or two court cycles from now?
Well, I think one of the things that came out in that conversation I had with Dean Chemerinsky from Berkeley is he feels probably fractionally stronger than I do that the court has actually decided these cases already, but they're doing them on the so-called shadow docket.
And yes, so, I wanted to talk to you about the shadow. Okay, talk about the shadow docket, because you have a great piece out where you're basically saying the court is now, you know, saying the quiet stuff out loud. Go ahead.
Well, the shadow docket is the notion that the court more and more is doing things in these perfunctory one-line orders in cases that are not argued or briefed. And so the term shadow docket, I think it was Will Bowd's term, Steve Laddick has written about it a lot. And it's the notion that the one thing the court has to do is have cases that are fully argued, fully briefed, and that are decided on the merits with full opinions.
Right.
And the shadow docket is the name for these late night orders that come out. We've seen them in a lot of death penalty cases, and we saw them in a lot of COVID cases, where the court doesn't go through that whole process. They just sort of smack down a two-paragraph order that doesn't fully reason out what's happening. And the cases that were quite worrisome that were decided on the shadow docket this year were some of the COVID cases, where you had religious entities that were challenging shutdown orders, for instance, in California and New York. And the court would say, no, if you have bike shops open, you have to open the churches. If you have nail salons open, you have to open the churches. Mm-hmm. And we had a series of those cases, but there's no real rule of the case. We don't know what the holding is. We just know that the court was saying, if Governor Newsom says that bike shops can be open, then all the churches get to be open. If there's an exception in some sense for the non-religious entity, there has to be an exception for the religious entity. And because those were decided on the shadow docket, their law, they're cited by other courts later.
Right.
But we don't know exactly what the ruling is. And so that's a long way of saying that what we saw on the shadow docket was this, the term that the religious liberty folks are using is most favored nation status. And that the idea is exactly that. if you give nail salons or casinos an exemption, you have to give it to the churches and the synagogues. That happened quietly on the shadow docket this year while nobody was watching. And I think the point that I was making in that article is that's exactly what just happened in Fulton, and we all missed it. What the court essentially said in Fulton is if you're going to grant some entities exceptions and exemptions, then religious liberty requires that you give those exemptions to religious entities. And that really is a revolutionary idea. And the concern, I think, that Dean Chemerinsky was expressing in that interview was, oh, actually, that already happened. It's just that it happened in a two-paragraph order on the COVID cases that was then imported into Fulton, and now it's the law. So I don't know if that was clear, but that's essentially the concern, is that the court is making law in the dark of night in three paragraphs with sometimes unsigned orders. We don't actually even know which justices sign off on some of these. and that can't be precedent, although it is becoming precedent. So I think that's the worry. And the worry is the shadow docket cases get decided on an exigency basis, right? This is an emergency. Donald Trump was big on running to the court and saying, yeah, right, it's an emergency. I don't want to go through all the hoops. Let's just get this thing enjoined. And I think the concern is we're going to have more and more and more emergencies, and the court's going to be making these decisions with these sort of back of the envelope orders.
I told you I'd bring the smarts on the Supreme Court, folks. I just told you. And Dahlia, yeah, she's got it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have more discussion on some of the Supreme Court cases out this week, what lies ahead, as we drill down on SCOTUS with Dahlia Lithwick. We'll be right back.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everyone. We're having a great conversation. I hope you've got notes, taking good notes here with Dahlia Lithwick. She has joined us from her perch over at the Slate, where she is a senior editor. And she has an upcoming book when is your book coming out, by the way?
We're going to know in a couple weeks.
Very good. All right. Well, we'll be looking out for Lady Justice, when it hits the Amazon, as they say. So we did this sort of drill down on Fulton. And the ACA was the case I was thinking about. We did reference that, where the Supreme Court didn't even bother. Just like, we're good. The other interesting case this week was a free speech case that was known as the Snapchat case. Where it ruled in favor of a Pennsylvania teenager who sued after a profane-laden diatribe on social media after she got banished, after she did not make the cheerleading squad or become cheerleading captain or something. And so she just went on Snapchat and just like lit into everybody. And the school banished her from the cheerleading squad because of her language and all of that. And walk us through that case and the implications of it from a free speech perspective.
Yeah, this was a case that got a ton of attention for, as you say, all the wrong reasons, right? You have a pissed off cheerleader, you got Snapchat, you've got her like giving the finger right to, you know, and all the F-bombs. And so it's one of those fun...
We won't even get into the parenting part here, because later for the Supreme Court, if you're my daughter and you put that up on social media, oh, trust me, sister, you and I are going to have a long ass conversation and you won't like the outcome.
Michael, I will tell you, my 18-year-old son, when I told him that the swearing cheerleader won yesterday, literally was like, oh, that's all she said? She just said a bunch of F-bombs? Like, I don't know. The ground is moving underneath us. But the short version is exactly what you said. She got passed over over for varsity cheerleading when she was a freshman. She's at a school in Pennsylvania. She goes to the local Cocoa Hut and takes a photo of herself, puts it on Snapchat, which by design is meant to disappear, right? That's part of the why right. Snapchat is nice. And she writes, F school, F softball, F cheer, F everything. It goes out to her 250 friends and is meant to disappear. Somebody screenshots it. It gets back to school administrators. The claim is made that this is disruptive and slightly threatening and very upsetting. And as you say, she gets benched from cheering. And her parents bring a suit claiming that this is a First Amendment violation, that she was not on school premises.
I have a problem right there. That the inclination of the parents, instead of disciplining their child's behavior in response to what happens to everybody else in the normal course of life, they go, oh, no, we're just going to sue. But that's a whole nother conversation, Dolly.
Well, here's what I will say in defense of the parents. The last time the court heard, and this is going to be more sympathetic, obviously, a big case in which they sided with the student was Mary Beth Tinker, right? Yes. 1969. Yep. And those were the kids who were disciplined for wearing black armbands to protest the Vietnam War. And that was a 7-2 decision for Mary Beth. And we hold her out today, she and her schoolmates, as heroes of student free speech, because we liked the speech that, or, you know, arguably we
I'd just say protesting the Vietnam War and the loss of life versus I didn't make the varsity squad. Okay, I'm with you. I'm there.
Okay,
go ahead.
All right. I'm just going to say we'll leave it. We'll agree to disagree, but we'll just say all of the heroes.
No, I get the free. I don't want now, y'all listen to me. I'm a huge free speech advocate, but as a parent, I'm just sitting there thinking that would not be my first inclination. I would actually probably wind up agreeing with the school because I'm like, nah, that's not how I raise my kids. You know, that's not how you respond to not getting your way or winning the day. But I'm digressing. It's just the dad in me coming out. That's all.
I hear you.
That's why God never blessed me with daughters. So that's because I would be awful. I'm just being so bad. But anyway, go ahead.
No, and to be fair, Clarence Thomas is the dissenter in this case, comes out 8-1 this week at the court. And Clarence Thomas is the dissenter who really feels, I think, that the school had every right to discipline Brandy Levy for her speech. But it's also just worth saying the, you know, history of First Amendment speakers is littered with like awful cross burners and like
sure,
draft
sure.
And like they're rarely lovely people saying lovely things. And the court tends to say, with a huge carve out for students, by the way, that we don't care if the speech is dumb or annoying or disruptive. We protect it in principle. Okay, bracket all that. Since the Tinker case, the court has decided a whole bunch of cases that encroach on the very, very broad notion in Tinker that students, quote, don't shed their First Amendment rights at the schoolhouse gates. And the fun one that everybody remembers is Bong Hits for Jesus, right?
Where
the
student
in Alaska with the big banner that says Bong Hits for Jesus, the court determines, again, John Roberts, that is pro-drug speech and it can be disciplined. So the reason that Brandy Levy is important is because the appeals court wanted to create a rule that said students can do whatever they want off campus. If they're off campus, they can write and say what they want. It does not cause the term after Tinker was material disruption at school. And so if she was at Cocoa Hut, she's off the hook. The court actually didn't agree to that. This week, the court said, nope, that is just too broad and sweeping a rule. There are going to be times when student speech off campus absolutely affects the discipline, the morale, the running of school. And so we're not going to accept this sweeping on campus, off campus kind of designation of what kind of speech is protected. So in a sense, they find for Brandy Levy and her parents, but what they don't say is what the Court of Appeals might have wanted, which is any student is free to say anything they want as long as they're not in school. Justice Breyer, writing for the majority, more or less says they're still going to allow schools to discipline, quote, serious or severe bullying or harassment, threats aimed at teachers, the failure to follow rules. He's not going to, in some sense, what he says is a school still has, quote, regulatory interests that are significant. And so even if you're off campus, even if it's Snapchat and it's going to disappear, the school has interests in disciplining some speech. And so, again, it feels like Fulton, it's a decision not to decide, right? They don't make right. a huge decision. They fine for Brandy and they say that speech simply didn't do to school discipline or regulations what the school claimed it did. And they don't actually set a hard and fast rule. What they do is they say, we're not going to reinforce the rule that any speech off campus is protected.
So this is where I come down a little bit with Clarence Thomas on this. And I totally appreciate it in sort of looking at how he framed his argument. I agree with him that the school has, to the point you just made, has an interest in protecting its image, yeah, but it, you know, how the students are an extension of the school that they attend. We all, you know, to this day, you know, 40 plus years after I've graduated high school, right? If I see someone, if I run into a friend or a brother, you know, from St. John's or Gonzaga, which are, you know, rivals for me in high school, we're going to throw down some smack about each other's school. There is a certain level of pride in that. And schools promote that. That's a selling point for them. It says a lot about their stature in the community and, you know, their worthiness, you know, how the public views them. It's an institution where, you know, young men and women attend and they become contributing members to our society. So I understand that, because in a certain sense, that idea is, to this young cheerleader's great dismay, she's going to run into this when she signs up and lands a job somewhere. And she goes out there and, trust me, if she commits an act on, quote, free speech that blows back on the company she works for, her ass is getting fired. So, you know, there's not going to, the CEO or your boss, her boss is not going to call her and say, well, you know, sweetheart, you shouldn't have done that. And we know you have a right to go out and say what you said. But regardless of the fact that we're now getting calls from clients who are looking to pull their accounts, right? So there are consequences here. How do we, I guess here's the question. What's the lesson taught to her? Because I don't think she's going to get the right lesson from this ruling, because it should also be a teachable moment. It's not just, oh yeah, we're going to side with you for showing your ass on Snapchat and dropping F-bombs as a 15-year-old, right? That's quote protected. But isn't there, and I know this isn't the court's role per se, but isn't there something else that we should also be concerned about here? Or am I just being too much of a dad right now?
I mean, no, you are pointing up one of the principal tensions in Supreme Court doctrine and precedent, which is you're never just deciding this case. You're deciding all the future cases that invoke the same principles.
Right.
And speech is, that's why I say it's just, these speech cases are full of just total jerks acting jerkishly. And the court bends over backward to protect jerks acting jerkishly because they know that it sweeps in important people talking importantly. And I think that speech is one of those areas. And we should have a whole conversation someday about speech cases, because this is the most speech protective court we've ever had in history, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And it time and time and time again, whether you like it or not, right, whether it's Citizens United, whatever it is, the court overwhelmingly signs off on very broad strokes ideas of what is speech and how it's protected. But they really struggle, Michael, with online speech. They're terrible at new technology. They're 10 years behind.
Yeah, what does that say, though? What does that say, Dolly? I mean, I think that's important because, I mean, this platform is, it's huge. I mean, it is, and if it's not regulated, or at least the last time it was regulated, as the commercials now are showing us and telling us, 25 years ago was the last time the Congress even did anything remotely touching on, updating the standards and the regulations around this. The court, I guess, is somewhat trapped, wouldn't you say? Or
it's
maybe
all private speech. I mean, this is not the government speaking, right? I mean,
right.
Part of the reason,
and that's the fundamental difference with First Amendment.
Exactly. That right. When people, you and I know, but I think a lot of folks know, don't know, that, you know, the First Amendment is implicated here, obviously, because it's public school. But 90% of the
just to cut you off, I don't mean to cut you, but is there a difference if this were a private school?
Yeah, I think so. That's a good question. I mean, I think that for sure it is absolutely implicit in this decision that you have, when it is the state acting, when it's a public school, you have greater First Amendment protections. But I think that it's just, we forget that all of the speech that we're doing online, right, when Donald Trump wants to be back on Twitter, we keep invoking First Amendment rights, but these are private actors, these are private companies. And so I think one of the things that the court is struggling with is that all of the speech we're talking about that happens, that we want regulated as though it's a government resource, is in fact privately owned, right? This is like for Jeff Bezos and others to decide. And so I think that the reason the court has been so slow to get into this space is that there just quite literally isn't a whole wealth of First Amendment doctrine around this. And so, and also, and here, this gets back to one of our original points, which is the justices can be really old. Sometimes when they, Justice Breyer famously called Twitter the tweeter one time at oral argument. I mean, they just don't necessarily understand what's coming, what's happening. This is actually a nice opinion because I think somebody's clerk took the time to explain Snapchat. But I do think that there is a whole host of questions that lie on the seam of a school that is terrified about bomb threats and death threats and harassment and bullying, all those legitimate First Amendment, you know, questions that collide with a school that understands that the difference between in school and out of school is gone with the internet age.
Right.
And the difference between what is a threat and what is not a threat is gone in the internet age. All of that stuff is terrifying school administrators. And that's what you're, I think, trying to pull at. And at the same time, even though all that stuff is gone, they have to craft rules for that moment. And so I think they're really struggling and they're stuck. And this is not a great opinion for pointing us toward what the line is.
Right. And that's why lack of congressional action is so glaring in this space, because the court has nothing to anchor it to other than the Constitution, which was written without Twitter or Snapchat. So it makes for an interesting challenge. But I think the big takeaway for folks to understand, and I do preach this a lot when I talk about free speech cases, a lot of Americans apply the First Amendment to everything. And what they need to understand is, I'm sorry, I can call you a son of a bitch for 24 hours a day straight, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it, except maybe bring a libel case against me or something like that. And you got to meet whatever that standard is. It is not an infringement on free speech, there's not a free speech harm here if you try to shut me down. I can't claim you're infringing on my rights. No, it doesn't work like that. It only deals with government action. It's the government's ability to stifle your speech. It's the government's ability to install or institutionalize religion. It's the government's ability to control the press that's about. And it's not about anything other. And I think we need to understand that. So it's time to have a little school rock education on the role of the First Amendment. And this, in this case, is a good platform on which to begin to understand that, I think, a little bit. But again, as a parent, and as a member of the broader society, you kind of look at it and you're, I don't even get to the free speech part. I'm still stuck on where was your mama and your daddy? And so, but anyway, so last question before I let you get out of here, because I know you got to go. And I kept you way longer than I promised I would because you're so smart and insightful. And it's such, been such a great conversation. What does the future of the court look like for you? What big case do you see coming up in the next case or cases you see coming up in the next term? And here's the third part of that. So what does the court look like? What big cases do you see coming up in the next term? And the third piece is, do you think Joe Biden is going to be able to get a Supreme Court justice on the bench?
I think the answer to what's coming up in the future is the stupid piece I referenced earlier when I said the court's not going to take abortion or gun cases. And they immediately took for early next fall. The court is going to hear a real, I think, substantial challenge to Roe v. Wade and Casey. And, you know, if the court decides they want to kind of cut out the heart of reproductive freedom, they'll be able to do that. So that's coming. And also a gun case that is going to, I think, really redefine the contours of the gun rights that
more
we're
so leading. Than Heller?
Yes, more so, because it's a much more expansive set of questions. And this, this is an issue that Clarence Thomas has been very frustrated since Heller and McDonald, you know, really wanting the court to have a more robust Second Amendment doctrine. And I think that's coming too. And then possibly a challenge to affirmative action is coming. So I think next term is going to be, to the extent that you and I agree that this term was a kind of a, okay, interesting, right, but not a, you know, no boomies. I think the boomies are coming. And then I think there's this lingering question about Justice Breyer. He's 82. Is he going to step down? So that's what we're watching for. And then your last question is exactly the right one, which is Mitch McConnell went on Hugh Hewitt's show and said unequivocally, the new rule is that if I control the Senate, Biden doesn't get to put a nominee up, not just in 2024, he said, but wouldn't actually say whether he would do it in 2023. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is this shimmering anxiety on the left that with a 50-50 Senate, it could change tomorrow. And at that point, there's no replacement for Breyer. It is very much animating the court reform question. You know, Biden has this commission that's studying structural court reform, whether that is, you know, quote unquote, court packing or expanding the court or, you know, 18-year term limits or adding, a rotating numbers of judges that swap in from the federal appeals courts. There's a whole bunch of ideas in play. But I think that what you're hearing from the left is if Mitch McConnell really is going to say, you know, it's my court and you only get to be here at my sufferance, then there's going to have to be a serious conversation about court reform. And we are awaiting Biden's commission and the recommendations that they make. At that point, we can have a conversation about whether the whole court is going to change.
Well, you're coming back when that happens. Letting everybody know, you know, Dolly will be back. And here's the second piece. I can damn Skippy assure you that if Biden gets an opportunity to replace Breyer, McConnell won't play. But if one of the conservative justices, for whatever reason, by an act of God or health, is no longer on the court and he gets to replace a conservative judge, McConnell is no way on this planet going to allow for that, which puts the Joe Manchins of the world in a very sticky space when it comes to the filibuster, since McConnell's already abolished the filibuster on Supreme Court nominations anyway. So this will be a very interesting conversation. She is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. Just a delightful conversation. And this time blew by for me, and I kept you well over when I said I'd let you go, and you've been very kind and patient. But it's so fascinating, and it's such an important part of our national discussion right now that really shows up what we don't know and understand about the Supreme Court. You brought a lot of light to some of the recent cases and the history, and I thank you very much for that.
Thank you very, very much for having me. It was a real treat.
Well, I appreciate it. It was a treat for us as well. And I want to thank everybody for joining us in this conversation with Dahlia Lithwick. You can certainly catch her in her writings over at Slate, and look for her new book coming out, Lady Justice. Don't forget to do that download thing. We love it when you do that, folks. Get me on Twitter at Michael Steele. What's your Twitter? So folks can follow you on Twitter.
Oh, I haven't tweeted since 2013.
Okay, that's fine. No, you know what? I totally understand it. You don't want to play. I totally get it. Totally get it. But you can certainly follow her writings over at Slate. Until next time, folks, be safe, be well, and take care. Get vaccinated if you haven't. It's for all the good reasons to do that. And until next time, peace out.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.